derogatory comments about women in the audience. Earlier this year, the outspoken MEP used the term Bongo Bongo Land. Our reporter Darren McCaffrey at the conference in central London says there are calls from within his party for Mr Bloom to quit.
Diane James, she stood in the Eastleigh by-election as the candidate there. She said that he should consider his position. And Godfrey Bloom has tweeted in which he said that he made a purposely outrageous joke among friends, which was taken as a joke by the women present, and it should not be taken out of context by a hostile press.
Police believe they've caught the Mr. Big of the UK cybercrime following a high-tech bank heist. Eight men have been arrested after £1.3 million was stolen from a branch of Barclays in North London by a gang who took control of its computer system. Former MSP Bill Walker is being criticised for showing no remorse after he was jailed for 12 months for domestic abuse. The 71-year-old was described as domineering by the sheriff, who gave him the maximum possible prison sentence. He abused three ex-wives and a stepdaughter over almost three decades. Walker's lawyer Russell McFate says he plans to appeal.
Clearly he's disappointed at the outcome. He is still maintaining his innocence. An appeal has been marked. The question of his interim liberation pending the appeal will be heard by the High Court probably at the beginning of the week.
A paedophile who posed as a schoolboy online has been jailed for 8 years. 24-year-old James Stone from Nottingham lured a 15-year-old girl into meeting him for sex. He admitted several offences. Campaigners warn plans for a smoking ban in jails in England and Wales be difficult to implement. A pilot scheme's expected to begin next year. And Royal Mail says it's disappointed. Postal workers are pressing ahead with a ballot for strike action. The company warns it could be damaging for customers and business. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
Yes, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. So helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Henbury and the Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council Conservative Group, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, tension cools off in Syria. We hear from an Iranian in Bristol, Mehrnaz Shahabi, to get her thoughts on the Syrian civil war, chemical weapons, and also the new regime in her home country, Iran. Plus, who was Jack the Ripper? An exclusive interview which has recently been uploaded onto YouTube with author Stephen Knight, who wrote Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution back in the 1980s and spoke to people who were intimately involved. Or at least their son, anyway, because obviously they're dead by the 1980s. And also Martin Summers will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots too. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 and dry. This weekend, highs of 21 Celsius, a little warmer, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells too. Highs next week around 23 degrees Celsius. Looks like the last little burst of summer, doesn't it? A fairly sunny week. Next weekend, that's the 28th and 29th of September, highs of 16 and sunny spells continue. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Henbury and the Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council's Conservative Group, Mike Weston. Hi, Mark, and welcome to Drive Time.
Afternoon, good to be back.
Now, just another little question about this guy, John Goulandris. I have to keep asking about him because I keep trying to arm twist him and persuade him to come on the radio and tell us all about the financial system, especially since he works for Coutts, the Royal Bankers, and he's your party whip. Tell us a bit about John.
I'm not sure you want me to tell. John's a good guy, he's a friend of mine. I need to keep asking him.
Yeah, I will. What is the whip's role within the Conservative group then, or in any group?
Well, actually, the whip's role, there's two roles. One is sort of a party discipline, and the other one is inter-party relations. So if there's an issue with all the parties, often John will be the one that goes to chat with them about what they're doing, how we're going to work together or not work together, etc. And one in party discipline is if there's a vote coming up, John makes sure, tries to ask, you know, how we're looking to vote. Is everyone on board? If they're not on board, prior notice, that kind of thing.
So does he have any kind of other role? So if you've been being good and doing what John asks you for the last 2 or 3 years, you
he doesn't pat us on the head and rub our belly. No,
no, but can he help sort of promote you up through the system, give you a bit of a portfolio if you're a good person?
That isn't within John's power to do. We try and reward when it comes to ability rather than anything else. No, John doesn't have that sort of grace and favour. But what John is, John, the whip has to sort of be the friend to everyone, try and make sure that they know what's going on and sort of we know what they're doing. Party discipline makes it sound a little strange, but what it means is, say a vote's coming up and the group position is one thing. Well, are you happy with the group position, or is there a problem? We don't have an issue with people voting another way. Often there are local issues or personal issues that mean they can't. We just like to know prior notice.
I noticed here at the full council meeting there was a quite important vote about blacklisting. I noticed that all the Conservatives voted against it. Why was that? Because blacklisting is one of those things that, why should the council be doing deals and handing out public contracts to companies that are blacklisting their employees? In other words, doing things like if they start flagging up health and safety issues, stopping them from working.
Two things. First of all, I'm afraid to say that was the one council meeting I wasn't actually at, because I'm afraid I was in Cornwall. My daughter's young and I can get her out of season, so I do go away then. So I wasn't there, but what this is, it's about the new waste contractor. The new waste contractor apparently has a secret blacklist and all the rest of it, anti-trade union. But
these are the guys that have taken over.
They've taken over
Magirney, somebody called Keir, I think.
Taking over Group, Keir, and apparently they have a policy on it. Now, I wasn't at the vote, but I do know the way we were going on it. None of this is sort of proven. It's all, well, we've heard this is their policy. Well, it's not written down. It's a secret policy if it is a policy, and if it isn't, we're just spreading rumours about it. So we're not about to jump overboard when there is no evidence on it.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. Give us an idea of your role, wider role. You're deputy leader of the Conservative Group. What other committees are you on, Mark?
I'm on finance and resources. I'm on audit. I'm the chair of sustainable development and transport. And there are various little subgroups of that appear.
Now, that audit committee sounds like quite an important one. What have you been up to there?
Well, the audit one, I was chair until I became chair of transport. It looks at the processes behind what the council does. Yeah, it doesn't actually look at the end decision, but have we reached that decision by a proper means? It's often confused with the finance side of it, but it isn't. It's about things like, do we have a good whistleblowing policy? What is our policy on tackling fraud? What are the internal processes by which we make a decision? And are they soundly based? That's the kind of thing on audit.
Okay, but that's, I mean, there's a massive budget to look at. I mean, how do you actually go into decide what detail you're going to go into?
Right, now you're on to the finance and resources. Now, what we do then is you have your budget monitoring. So as you go along through the year, you see what you should be spending, what you have spent, what is the difference, why is there a difference? If it's an overspend, are we going to get it back down? If there's an underspend, well, also, why is that underspend come through? So you do scrutinise on that. But you'd also take specific projects as the year goes on that you might want to look into. You might want to look at things like the rent arrears or council tax arrears, what's happening, what are the processes there. So it is broad. You can't cover everything, but what you're trying to do is pick the hot spots and go for those.
So what have you been diving into and having a look at recently?
Well, on audit or finance resources or transport?
I'm just thinking about the last one, which was finance.
Okay, on finance, well, today we actually had several reports. One of them was talking about the welfare changes and what their impact on Bristol is going to be. It's kind of a one-sided report because it kind of focused on the negative side of it rather than any of the positive on it. But we were looking at how that will impact on Bristol's economy. In addition, you start looking at, well, what are the changes on the council's budget, because the council's got about £350 million budget, but it's expected to save around £80 million, we think, over the next 3 years. So how is that process going to be reached? And we're going to know more about that in the weeks to come, because that's when the mayor starts to publish his actual budget.
And so what involvement do you have in that process? Because the mayor now is in charge. Can he not just decide what he's going to do and you have to just accept it?
No, actually, budget is sort of the one area where we do have control on him, because he'll present his budget at the budget meeting in February, and the council can kick it out. We can reject his budget. That is, you know, he has total executive...
The only power the council really has anymore.
Well, sort of, but actually not quite. That's the hard power we have. But what he also has to have, he has to have a cabinet, which means he needs to build a consensus. And, you know, if he doesn't have the cabinet, doesn't have a consensus, and people willing to work with him, and we've been willing to work with him from the beginning, even though we don't agree on everything, then you start to paralyse the council. We can't remove him, and he does have executive power, but I have to say, as an opposition councillor, I've not noticed a great deal of difference between the way George Ferguson acts and the way that the previous administrations acted.
Okay, on the transport committee then, because this is a biggie, you've got all this rest of parking going on. We've also got a transport mess out there quite often. I mean, you texted us tonight to say you're having trouble getting here.
It can't just be me, but it seems like the council is digging up the entire city centre. It just feels that way. You keep hitting roadwork after roadwork in succession, and you kind of sit there going, well, why? No, we do look at various things, but it's not just it's transport and it's transport and sustainable development. So you'll be looking at residents' parking zones, which we looked at before the summer, but you'll be also looking at things like the bus rapid transit. You'll be looking at potential for rail improvements.
Okay, well, let's just
air quality. There's a huge realm.
Let's look at this whole business of any kind of advanced public transport. So it's so desperately needed in the city, getting almost nowhere with First Group, other than the news a couple of weeks ago that they may be taking Bristol Pounds, which sounds a little bit better, but you know, there's a serious problem with the price of fares.
I've got to say, whether First takes Bristol Pounds or not is absolutely beside the point when it comes to our bus fiasco. We have a problem at the moment where we heavily subsidise First. You know, to run certain uneconomic routes, but they can randomly change the timetable, the routes, cancel them without any input from the council. I just don't think we're getting the best deal from the bus company we should be. Now, I'm by birth a Liverpudlian, and when I sit there and compare what Mersey Travel is like and how that runs to what we have, it just doesn't compare at all.
So what are you doing to change things?
Well, actually, our committee is looking in depth on the buses at the moment. Now, the buses are doing their fares fair consultation. That's finished. The results are going to come out on what the pricing is going to be. I actually start to wonder whether we need to be taking the buses back under control like they do in Liverpool.
Oh, how would you do that?
Well, you can look at quality contracts. This is one of the things that we're going to be looking at on the 19th of December. So it's a Christmas treat for you, Tony. You should come along and listen to that. You'll love it. Don't roll your eyes. It'll be exciting. But it's looking at how things work in other cities and can we learn any lessons, but also how we can start to join up our various transport systems. We keep talking about an Oyster card or Cabot card, Brunel card, whatever you want to call it. But why can't we have something like that already? Why can't you move between buses and trains with the one purchase of a ticket? They have it in so many other cities, and yet we seem incapable of doing it. And I personally think that's because First are dragging their feet.
But isn't it? I mean, you need some kind of strategic transport authority, which is looking at it a wider perspective.
I would agree.
Railways, Bath, you know, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire.
You'd have the west. You'd have the whole west of England in it, ideally, because buses don't stop at the border. They cross the borders, that's the whole point. And we have actually seen some, I would say, unwelcome changes to buses coming in from North Somerset into Bristol, where some of the commuter buses have stopped now, or, you know, been cut or whatever. Now, that's going to be a problem, because actually, if you want to reduce car use in the city, which the mayor is hell-bent on, then you need to make sure that the public transport is there to meet the need as it moves away from the car.
So are we going to actually see any movement on this, or is this just more talk as we've had the last 10 years?
I would really hope so. The problem in the Transport Committee is we're a scrutiny committee. We don't have the ability to come up with the policy. That policy rests with the Mayor and Mark Bradshaw. Now, I might be speaking slightly out of turn on this. Mark Bradshaw is from a different party to me, but actually I think he's incredibly capable, and I really hope he's pushing this forward.
Do you think we're going to actually see any difference, though? Come on, Mark. Let's hear it from someone who's been on the inside of this. I think this is one thing that people in Bristol feel like they're banging their heads against a brick wall.
One of the
reasons the mayor was brought in is to make things like this happen.
It's why I'm so passionate when it comes to things like the Henbury Loop line and reinvesting in our rail and reopening our railway lines. And I really do believe that that is going to be a solution. I don't think the buses are going to provide the long-term solution, because all you're doing is just moving traffic that's already on the roads into other traffic that's already on the roads. I think the answer to it is actually to reopen rail. I do think there will be movement on this. It will never happen as quick as we want, but it will in the end get there.
But central government doesn't want to do this, do they? Because it will mean less fuel tax revenue.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, the country is dependent now on all these various kinds of forms.
Yeah, I hear a lot of things saying the country's dependent on various things, and then it changes. So I'm not going to buy that one. It's not the government. What the government's actually trying to do at the moment is push down local transport policy to the authorities, so one size doesn't fit all, and we can make it ourselves. But I think what we need is that integrated transport authority covering all of the immediate local councils around us, so we can have a proper joined up cohesive approach. Now that's starting to happen in the West of England partnership. They're starting to look at the strategic planning level. If you look at BR, Bus Rapid Transit, BRT, whether you like it or not, it has involved a lot of cross-border work that is a good thing, and hopefully a good stepping stone for further improvements.
Just to pick up on something we were talking about at the start, the blacklisting and Keir, I've just brought up an article from Unite the Union here, which is talking about their sacking of 28 workers on the London Crossrail project. These were trade union activists that were bringing up health and safety concerns. I mean, that's the same company that's now running our bin services.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I'm not saying there are concerns, but it's got to be proven. And it is innocent to proven guilty.
So is it a coincidence? The same 28 union activists, honestly, who were bringing up health and safety.
I'll give you an honest answer, Tony, and you can bank this. I don't know.
Okay. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We had a vote in the City Council last week to say that no, this was mainly abstentions from the Liberal Democrats, mainly against by the Tories, and certainly almost all Labour and Green councillors were for it, against blacklisting. Just give us a bit of background of how this has been going on over the years.
Well, I think this is actually following the Welsh Assembly's decision about this, because they were saying that, you know, companies which carry out this kind of blacklisting have got to expect that they're going to, you know, for example, they're not going to be given a look in for contracts with the Welsh Assembly or with the local council. I presume that the Labour people and the Greens have picked it up from the Welsh Assembly. And this, of course, is exactly what used to happen back in the day. I mean, gradually, the municipal socialists, as they were called in those days, used their purchasing power of local authorities to make sure that companies had proper health and safety policies, etc., etc. And I was very interested to hear Mark earlier say that that the possibility of taking the buses back into some kind of public ownership has crossed his mind. I mean, this is, to my mind, reinventing the wheel. I mean, this sort of stuff was just normal and is normal in other parts of Europe.
Well, it was here in Bristol, wasn't
it? It was here in Bristol.
Why go anywhere else in the country when we used to have a municipal service here?
I'm not being churlish here. I think once you deal with practical problems, then a lot of ideology falls away, and when we start to find that, you know, I mean, I'm sure that Mark does not believe that trade unionists should be persecuted for being members of trade unions. I mean, that's not a conservative view that I would recognise.
No, I don't agree at all with blacklisting remotely. I think that is wrong. Trade unions have a role to play. I may disagree with what that role is, but they do have a role to play. Just trying to be clear when it comes to the buses. When the buses were all sort of privatised and broken up, in some cities it's worked a treat. In other cities, they went down the integrated transport authority approach, like Liverpool, where it has also worked. But the problem in Bristol is we did run the buses. We didn't run them particularly well, truth be told. Then we tried privatisation, and it obviously first has a virtual monopoly on it, and I would argue that's not working particularly well. And if it doesn't work, you try something new. Now, the quality contract is sort of in between the privatisation and the sort of nationalisation.
Well, I'd like to know where it has worked, because I remember when I was living in Oxford, there were two competing companies, and the buses used to overtake each other, race each other down, you know, trying to get to the bus stop first.
Well, that sounds like
maniacs.
Nitrous oxide on the buses. What we're trying to do on the 19th of December is look at what all the options are. Well, I think what we'd all agree is the status quo isn't working, so you've got to look elsewhere. There are models that work. We can't really look at London, that's an entirely different model. But we can look at other core cities, other large cities, like Liverpool, like Newcastle, like Birmingham, and see what works there, and are there lessons that we can learn there. No point reinventing the wheel and then apply them to Bristol. And a quality contract might be one of those. I'm not saying it is, but it might be.
Okay, on the wider economy, Mark, what are your thoughts about George Osborne's speech beginning of last week, where he was talking about he's now saved the economy, everything's on the right track? What are your thoughts?
He didn't say that, Tony, and I think you know that because I'm sure you've read it. I think what he was saying was things look optimistic at the moment, but we're not out of the woods. And to be honest, he's probably right, but if anyone mentions green shoots, I will shoot them. It always makes me very nervous. Let's let this bed in. Things are improving. They're not good. They're improving. Okay, I think we just leave it at that.
What do you think the tactics are to get us out of a recession, and do you think that the central government's actually adopted them?
Yeah. Well, the problem... It's not just the recession. We also have to look at what the borrowing was and how that works. Now, for those that don't know, in 2010, government income was $541 billion, but government expenditure was $700 billion. You cannot keep borrowing at that rate and expect the economy to continue, because in the end, it will just crunch. You know, because this money either has to be printed and then you have runaway inflation, or it has to be borrowed from somewhere. And if the markets don't trust you to repay that money at any point, you can't borrow. So he had to take tough decisions and actually start to make cuts, and those cuts have come through, or are coming through. There are still quite a few to come, are coming through, but consumer confidence is up, employment is up, unemployment is going down. Things are possibly turning a corner, but we're at the shallow end of a recovery, and I don't think we should overreact.
He's really saying that I was right to adopt the policy. Martin, the economy's turning a corner, Chancellor George Osborne said last week. Has it? Is it?
Well, I think Mark's right to say nobody should be seeing this as... I mean, the economy is still smaller than it was in 2008. So even if we've turned the corner, we've still got some way to go back to where we started. I would argue that even if there is a recovery, we've lost several years of GDP growth, which we could have had. But I think the real problem is that the financial system as a whole, and it's nothing necessarily directly to do with British government policy, is actually not fit for purpose. And nobody really wants to face up to that. And as we saw this week, when the markets were expecting the tapering of quantitative easing in the US, and that started to cause panic. When they started talking about that a few weeks ago, it started to cause panic in stock markets around the world. And so they've rowed back from that, and they're basically saying we will carry on printing money indefinitely until the recovery takes hold. But I think basically that is delusionary, and that at some point the markets themselves will make the market solution to this, which is a crash. But I don't think any of our political leaders, and I include in this the leaders of the Labour Party, I hope the senior civil servants and the Bank of England people, who are not, don't say very much, I hope they are aware of the danger and have something in the pipeline if something drastic does happen.
Well, one person who would definitely agree with you, Mark, is someone on YouTube, people may have seen, Mark McGowan. He's called Chunky Mark. He's now likes to be known as the artist taxi driver. And he managed to pin down Labour MP John McDonald in the back of his taxi this week. So let's hear...
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. What they had to say.
I think we have, like, they've Jeremy Hunt's asking doctors to ask people for passports. Yeah. Do you think that this is a tactic by the Tories, by Linton Crosby, looking towards the next election, which will be on immigration, social security and prejudice?
It's the dog whistle politics that we expect. Well, it's happened already. But I don't think it's just a general election tactic. I think this has been a tactic that's been used consistently throughout our history. Yeah. You know, and, you know, whether it's the blacks, whether it's the Irish, or whether it's the Jews, or whoever, there's always got to be a scapegoat to cover the fact that it's the system that's corrupt and stinks that we have to change. I remember also, a few months ago, I exposed in Parliament that what they were going to do is get teachers to ask pupils their country of origin and their immigration status. Now, they backed off from that one because we kicked up a stink. What we've got to do is mobilise people, so we're not going to accept this anymore. I tell you, if those poster boards, those poster vans come in my constituency, we'll lie down in front of them. They won't dare come back again.
Well, he's talking about the system there, Martin, and he's also pointing towards immigration as becoming an issue for the next election.
Well, it clearly is an issue for the next election. I think what we've got to be absolutely clear is it's perfectly okay to talk about immigration as an issue. And I think, you know, UKIP are right to say that we shouldn't have it as a non-issue that we can't discuss. But I think, on the other hand, what John McDonald is saying, we don't want people being scapegoated because of failures, for example, of the economic system. We're going to stop scapegoating the people who cook funny food, the people who don't look like us, and all the rest of it. We know where that leads. And we've seen in this week, for example, the Golden Dawn fascists police in Greece have murdered a young rap singer because they didn't like his politics. We don't want to go down that sort of road, do we?
Mark, what are your thoughts about what Chunky Mark and John McDonald are saying there, which is essentially that the system is broken? We really need to look at changing the system.
I'm not quite sure which system they're referring to.
I think they're talking about the financial system, ultimately, aren't they?
I'm not sure they are. I think they're talking about the immigration system. I do think immigration is an issue. I genuinely think... I mean, if you look at what happened in 2004, when the Eastern European bloc sort of joined the EU, Britain, I think Sweden and Ireland were the only ones that didn't put in any immigration controls. And we had 600,000 Eastern Europeans come to this country. And we know that because they're the ones that registered, and I suspect a few more came that didn't register, and the total may well be over a million. And on the whole, they've come here and they've worked hard. It's been great. But the problem is that larger increase in such a short space of time in population puts severe pressure on all kinds of services.
So weren't English people working hard before that?
Well, we do actually have a problem. Jamie Oliver wasn't totally wrong when he was talking about this. That we do have an issue that there were jobs that weren't being filled, and so you do need a certain level of immigration to fill them because people aren't a certain level. Now, I would argue the immigration level is too high and it has to come down. I hope it will. But equally, you do need to then change the welfare system to get people off welfare and into those jobs. They may not be the jobs they want, but they do have to fill them.
Well, do you agree then with this whole principle of economic migration? People going around the world to suit, you know, to suit themselves and whichever country they can get paid best in anywhere?
Well, no, actually. I do think that the best thing that we can do in Britain is, rather than export our finest around the world, is make sure those finest are valued in Britain, but also make sure that we are taking up the jobs that are available in our country. And there were jobs, but we weren't filling them.
But the brain drain is as big
brain
now
drain
as ever,
is a
isn't
massive
it?
Issue.
Yeah. So why is it that we're, you know, educating people very well here who then just immediately leave?
Because they take the opportunity. In the end, they'll act in the best interest of their family and themselves, and they go to where the best opportunity for them is. And that's a loss for Britain, which is why I think we should be doing as much as we can to value those minds and those abilities in Britain and encouraging the kind of high-tech work and research and things like that that should be going on.
So, Martin, where do you draw the line between acceptable criticism of immigration and unacceptable?
Well, it's basically around the idea of racism. I think, basically, I'm prepared to have anybody from anywhere in the world in this country, as long as they've come in properly with a proper visa and there's been an arrangement for them to come. I think, as you say, Britain decided not that you can't ultimately stop movement within the EU. There's free movement of labour. And, of course, we've got lots of Brits living in the south of Spain, for example.
Well, that's expanding the EU, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but don't forget, I used to work in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that was a great achievement for the whole of Europe. And if we were not to allow those people to... I mean, you know, when people used to climb over the Berlin Wall and escape to Germany, they used to be clapped and cheered. Now, of course, we've got border guards trying to stop them coming through. And I think this is a problem all over the world, especially because we've got a global economic crisis, yeah. Is that everywhere, everybody feels threatened by people. I mean, in Poland, for example, at one stage they weren't allowed to come in Britain when I lived over there. And Poles would say to me, look, we fought on your side in World War II, we're your oldest friends, why can't we come to Britain? I said, do you want everybody in Russia to come to Poland? They went, no. I said, well, you see the problem then, don't you? And this is the issue everywhere. And it's the same in Australia, the same everywhere.
I think we probably both agree, we don't mind people coming to Britain, that they come here to work and work hard and contribute to our society. That is fine. What the fear is that too many come to this country either on welfare tourism or they come here not to work. Whether that fear is founded or not, that is the fear.
Well, what if they come and work for half of the wages that an English person needs for 2 years and then take the money back somewhere else?
Well, no, hold on. There is a minimum wage on this. They can't go below that. And if they are going below that, then the employer should be prosecuted.
The minimum wage is barely livable.
Yeah, the minimum...
But at least there is one.
At least there is one. You look at Germany and there isn't one, okay? So we need to be careful exactly... We start criticising our own people and government on this one. There is a minimum wage here. If employers are paying below the minimum wage, and that is a criminal act, and they should be prosecuted. So we shouldn't have a situation where people can come in from abroad, work for cheaper than the Brits, rip us off, and then go back. That isn't right. And actually, I would argue that that's the employer ripping off his immigration labour force as much as Britain is overall for what's going on.
Well, talking about ripping us off, one news story this week. It's a chap called Everett Stern, who's a whistleblower from the bank HSBC. And he spoke to New York's We Are Change representative Luke Radowski this week. He was talking to him about his job in HSBC, which was to do with terrorism and drug cartel policing. And it turns out that HSBC were actually twisting the figures and allowing terrorists and drug cartels to use HSBC to do money laundering.
Is criminal manipulation of the wire filter. So there are certain names that OFAC bans, where certain companies and people we can't do business with, and they're listed in an actual filter. So what these geniuses at HSBC figured out was to just change the codings on the names a little bit, add a dot or a dash, so it wouldn't match with the wire filter and the payments would go through. And that's how hundreds of millions of dollars went from Kariba supermarkets in Africa and Gambia to drug cartels, Russian mobsters, any bad guy you can possibly think of. Yeah. I can't comment on why they did it, but I'll tell you, though, how they're still doing it. What they did is that when I joined, they only had maybe 15 compliance officers in the whole department in Newcastle, Delaware. So what they did was they sold off their credit card division to Capital One, and they took all these debt collectors and customer service agents, and they fired them, and then they rehired them as anti-money laundering compliance officers, and with no AML experience, nothing, and they're still there now approving transactions, and they showed the government, oh, wow, we have this huge anti-money laundering compliance program, and the whole thing's a sham. There is no anti-money laundering program. Yeah, I was a anti-money laundering compliance officer there. Out of business school, I was a candidate for the clandestine service before I joined HSBC. I joined October 2010. 3 weeks in, I started passing information to the CIA and was doing that for about a year. Yeah, I mean, HSBC is threatening me with legal action. I really don't care, I mean, it's a national security issue. My sole objective is to protect the United States of America, so I don't care.
Was HSBC held responsible for their criminal activity?
No, they were fined $1.9 billion, and they should have gone to jail. I mean, if I were to donate $1 to Hamas or Hezbollah, I'd go to jail for life. I mean, these guys are just no consequence at all, and they're still doing it. And we're talking to the Zeta drug cartel. I mean, 500,000 Americans die a year from drugs. I mean, a block away, there's a bank that's giving money to the drug cartels. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, from a block away from here, and they're supporting it, and we're allowing that to go on, but all because the administration says they don't want to cause a financial crisis? Yeah. If there's another 9/11, I can guarantee you that's going to cause another financial crisis.
Well, that was Everett Stern there speaking at the second anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street protests over in New York earlier this week. Mark, I mean, he's talking there about billions of fraud by HSBC. No prison sentences at all. And yet we have an announcement from the Chris Grayling this week, I think it was, saying that if people are doing benefit fraud, they could be in jail for up to 10 years.
Well, actually, I would come down hard on any fraud. So whether it's happening in the boardroom or whether it's happening on benefit fraud, come down hard on both. I personally do not get why, if a bank is carrying out practices like that and, you know, it is proven and is provable in court, then I'm sorry, someone has to go to jail. Someone has to change the code like that. So it's not a mistake. Someone's gone in there and deliberately done it. Now, it might be that someone was ordered to do so, at which point they're in trouble.
Isn't it?
But also the person,
not in a wink, isn't
but
it?
The person that ordered it also goes, and not being funny, these chief executives and these board members are getting remunerated rather handsomely for this. They carry the responsibility. When things go good, great, we should applaud them. But when they go bad, they take the rap.
But they're not likely to give straight orders, are they? It's likely to be a nod and a wink, Mark, surely.
It happens on their watch. You hold them accountable. I personally, whether it's a nod and a wink or whether it's written in an email, you hold them accountable and they should go to jail.
Martin?
Well, I agree with
that. I mean, we've heard the system there seems to be, what's going on in HSBC, according to this whistleblower, is that there are codes which are used for terrorist groups and drug cartels so that they know where these bank accounts are, and yet someone has just changed one little digit on that code so that the transactions for these terrorists and drug cartels all go through.
Well, yes. I mean, the UN report on drugs and crime, which came out in 2009, which is basically written by police officers working for the UN, said that during the financial crisis of 2008, all of the dirty money around the world was sucked into the system in one go because they were having a panic, they needed funds, and essentially the drug cartels bailed out the financial system. That's the reality of the situation.
I thought we bailed out the financial system.
The financial system is being kept going by the taxpayer and the drug cartels. That is it. I mean, you think I'm exaggerating. The UN report on this...
Mark, you're groaning there. Just explain why.
I realise... No, I'm not buying that one. Look, the financial crisis... The banks have taken drug money, and I'm sorry, those that have done it, they're culpable. If the boardroom and all the rest of this, you go to jail, that's wrong. But I'm not going to buy that the entire international banking system is being held afloat by drug money.
That's what the UN report on drugs and crime said, written by police officers.
I'm sure everything the UN says is absolutely accurate.
As we know about the bedroom tax. Anyway,
I'm not going to buy that the entire financial system is being held up by drug money.
All right, well, let's...
I'm not denying it's in there, whoever let it in...
Well, as you rightly say, HSBC's executives should have gone to prison, but of course Lord Green didn't go to prison. He was appointed to to David Cameron's cabinet. Why isn't he in prison? Good question. Gabe Galbraith's son, Peter Galbraith, who's an academic economist in the US, says you should expect to see thousands of executives in prison at this stage. During the 1930s, the Pecora Commission in the US sent thousands of executives to prison. During the savings and loans scandal during the Reagan era, over 1,000 top executives were sent to prison. So far, we've seen Bernie Madoff, who's just ripping off rich people. He's been sent to prison. But as I pointed out, Lord Green, who was in charge of HSBC at the time, not only is not in prison, he's in the cabinet.
OK, thanks, Martin. Now, this week, I came across a little protest going on in the city centre here, and it was of Avon and Somerset NAPO, the National Association of Probation Officers, who are worried about the plans to privatise the probation service. So let's have a listen now for Avon and Somerset area. Kerris Handley.
My name is Kerris Handley. I am chair of NAPO for Avon and Somerset. I'm here today to introduce some information to the public to let them know about the consequences of the planned privatisation of the probation service. The Secretary of State has a plan that would mean the changeover from the National Probation Service to what's called a holding company would happen on the 1st of April 2014, and that as of the 1st of November 2014, private companies who've been successful in bidding and have got contracts to run our work would then take over on the 1st of November.
Well, for those who've never come across it, what does the Probation Service do?
We manage offenders in the community, serious risk offenders such as paedophiles, sex offenders, murderers. We manage high risk, those who are prolific offenders and they're in a cycle and they can't get out of it, or they don't want to get out of it. We manage them and we monitor them. And we also monitor offenders who only come onto our radar once. It's literally a blip. So we manage a whole spectrum of people who are in the community. They've been sentenced by a court, been convicted of a crime, and they've been sentenced to a certain amount of time to be spent with the probation service. They either come from the prison, because they do a custodial sentence, and then they come to us, and we manage them from then on, or the court actually sentenced them to a community sentence of some description, and we monitor them and we supervise them. The shadow minister, Sadiq Khan, has written to Mr. Grayling, the Secretary of State, and has asked Chris Grayling, where are all the legal papers for this privatisation? Because at the moment we can't find any. We can't find any actual indication that it isn't just more than an idea that's been come up. Now, Grayling has actually put together a bill. It's called a Transforming Rehabilitation Bill, and under that he states a lot of things that he would like to change about the probation service, but in order to do that he wants the private companies to come in and take over the financial responsibility and the management of the probation service. And in fact, what will happen is we will no longer be a national probation service. We'll be fragmented into pots all over the country managed by private companies. The problem is, at the moment, Mr. Grayling's plans, his plans are in draft. Now, all of that could be done as the probation trusts exist. We don't need to be privatised to do these things. If this all goes ahead, there's no guarantee that the current professional, experienced and trained staff of the probation service will stay with the private companies once the 1st of November 2014 comes round. We've not been given any guarantee that will happen. If that is the case, and the private companies have their own staff running probation, Group 4 Securicom and Serco are currently responsible for some tagging, but that's the limit. That is the absolute limit of experience that any of the companies will have of offenders. We do know that Group 4 Securicom and Serco are currently under criminal investigation for fraudulent behaviour, and yet Mr. Grayling thinks it's okay for them to bid for the contracts for managing offenders in the community. And I pause there because I'm basically asking the public, do they think that's right?
Well, I suppose I should pitch that to you, Mark. Is it right that companies which are under criminal investigation, I understand £2 million fraud by Serco and G4S is being investigated now by the Public Accounts Committee, and in fact they're having what they're called forensic investigations, which G4S had been resisting. Is it right for them to be bidding to take over management of these serious offenders, such as paedophiles and murderers?
Well, I think that there are two issues here. There's one about the specific companies, and actually I think when a company is facing this kind of investigation and questions to its character, then I would argue that ideally no, but in fairness you have to prove the guilt first. Okay, on this, it's not ideal, but we do live in a country where it's innocent to proven guilty.
Well, G4S do have a bit of a track record on this, don't they?
I'm not denying that one, but we do have to be careful on it. Until we prove that they've done what they've done, then they can act like every other company. But you come back to actually the underlying issue is, should we be privatising the probation service? And what was absent there was the fact that the reoffending rate is 26.8%, and it's actually gone up this year. So I'm sure a lot of probation officers do a lot of good work, but the system isn't working the way that it should be. If we're having that high a reoffending rate, there were 500,000 crimes committed by ex-prisoners within 1 year of them being released. You have to try something new. What's there at the moment isn't working, and that wasn't mentioned there.
Okay, Mark, what about the training? Because Kerris was saying there that there's no guarantee that people who are already trained, Martin, are actually going to keep their jobs, and that there may be all sorts of new people come in who haven't had special training in dealing with offenders.
Well, I think that's right. I think basically you've got to listen to the people on the front line, whether it's police officers, probation officers or prison officers. And also I would argue that the criminal justice system is not a place where people should be looking to make a profit out of what they're doing. That gives a perverse incentive. For example, G4S, for example, were claiming that they'd tagged people that they hadn't tagged, or people who left the country and were dead and so on. And of course the reason for doing that is because they were making money on it. Now, whatever failings the probation service may have, they're not cutting corners to save money, because they're not actually a private company. And that is rather important.
What Mark was saying, they're being paid by results. So in other words, if there's no reoffending, so the company gets paid more.
Well, I can see what there might be an argument about, we've got to try and get payment by results or whatever, but as the colleague said, there's no reason why we couldn't have a system that puts this in place which doesn't involve privatisation.
Well, that's certainly one to watch, privatisation of the probation service, and the campaign there by NAPO just launched in Bristol this week. But I'm also joined now by the Regional Secretary of the Communication Workers Union, Kevin Beezer. Hi Kevin, welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now this is the Royal Mail. Let's just get it absolutely clear, the Post Office and Royal Mail are separate. Can you tell us what's the latest with this proposed privatisation? How far down the road are we, and what's it going to mean for us?
Well, we're at a defining moment in well over 350 years in Royal Mail. This particular issue about privatisation has gone on for something like 21, 22 years with various different governments and different guises about part privatisation and full privatisation. The coalition government have announced, which isn't a big surprise, I suppose, that they're going to move to privatise. And obviously the unions and the members that we represent are obviously against that, but it's not just us in isolation. We've got, I think the last YouGov poll, there was 70% of the general public that were against privatisation. We've got the small business community against privatisation, Postmasters Federation against privatisation, and various other groups that have joined the coalition, if you want to use that word, against privatisation, including councillors from all parties. And I think really it's an opportunity tonight to get to the crux of the debate, because there's lots of things that have been said about this debate that perhaps aren't strictly true.
Well, tell us about some of those. I mean, I suppose the bottom line is, what is this going to mean in 2 or 3 years' time?
Well, what we can foresee is the breakup of the Universal Service. Now, although the coalition government and various governments have said, well, it's enshrined in law and the Universal Service will carry on and you'll see no changes.
This is the idea that this is you can post one letter from anywhere in the country and it costs the same.
One price fits all, 6 days service, John O'Groats to Land's End, etc. However, you know, nobody can be that stupid to realise that any private company in the future, when you look at, you know, remote geographical areas, and if you look at the southwest, and in particular, if you want to use an example, you look at Cornwall, where there's postmen and women going into very remote locations, where it's not cost effective. It's just not cost effective. The only way that supplements that is the mainstream business that comes into the post office, which obviously private operators will look to cherry pick, which we've already got to a certain extent now. We've got in London TNT that are delivering mail from 6:30 in the morning to 6:30 at night on 0 hour contracts on £7.10 an hour that are, you know, undercutting Royal Mail. Ironically, when they can't deliver it, they dump it back into the system. But what, you know, the argument is about investment. You know, we've gone through a very difficult time in Royal Mail, and our members have gone through a difficult time. We've had major agreements with the employer, and we've turned this business round. Currently, it's made £404 million. It must make a fair amount of money, because the chief executive got £1.5 million in her pay and bonuses recently. And also, we look at the rail track model. Well, actually, you know, rail track, owned by the taxpayer, is allowed to borrow money through the government. So what we're saying to the government is that if it's good enough for Railtrack and we're making a profit, why at this particular time, when we've got something in the public sector that the taxpayers own, sell it off for investors to come in, asset strip the company? It doesn't make any sense. We can borrow that money in the public sector. It's good enough for Railtrack. And this isn't popular. Let's get back to it. You know, this is not popular with the general public. It's not popular with the business community. And I've been out meeting various groups, let alone my own members, and I've not come across one person that comes up and says this is a great idea. So I'd hope, you know, the party, the coalition parties, or any other party for that matter, take notice of what people actually think in this country, instead of just sticking to 1980s politics.
Well, it's not certainly not just the Conservatives that are steering this through, because Vince Cable's been a big champion of it for the Lib Dems too. Mark, why are the central government doing this? Because, I mean, as Kevin's saying there, it certainly isn't popular. Why can't we keep this £404 million in taxpayers' hands to actually help with the national economy that goes into the Treasury rather than going into private pockets of shareholders?
I mean, I think we also at this point need to mention the fact that Labour were also championing this in 2009. Nigel Mandelson shelved it as well. And I realise harking back to the Lord of Darkness isn't necessarily a good thing, but Labour certainly were all in favour at one point. Just coming on to, the company itself does need a lot of investment. We have to look very carefully at exactly what the government continue to borrow money for. I think the investment can come from the private sector coming in and running this. I don't take your the scare when it comes to the danger of the universal service. I mean, you mentioned TNT. Now, TNT, obviously, or they've been complaining for a while about the VAT benefit that Royal Mail has over them and the advantage. But they actually run the universal service in Holland, or their owner company does. And they've continued to run it that way, and it still runs 6 days, as far as I'm aware. So this is a change for Royal Mail, but it's also an opportunity for Royal Mail. The government have taken off the pension liability, which was massive, and they've taken that off entirely. And then I think this is possibly a bright future for the Royal Mail, because it needs to bring in that private investment. And if you look at what some of these privatisations that have happened in the past, you know, on your list that you kind of provided, you know, Rolls-Royce, British Airways, these have worked. These run efficiently, and they run well.
What about the railways, the electricity, the energy side of things, the water?
Yeah, but the thing is, did it work well before? No. Yeah, not being funny, there were problems when it came to, you know, British Rail. It was a running joke. And when you look at some of the other things that were privatised as well, they didn't work. Now, they may not be working now as ideally as they want, but they also weren't working then either.
Surely the main point here, Mark, is that, you know, these were services which were provided at cost. Now, what we've got to pay on top of that is fat cat boss salaries, and also we've got to keep the shareholders sweet. It's bound to cost more.
Hang on a minute. As you just said, the boss of Royal Mail just took $1.5 million in a pay packet and all the rest of it. So I would argue possibly the fat cat bosses are already getting rather fat on this one. The company itself makes a profit. That is a good thing. The company should make a profit. It should reinvest it in it. If the investors come in, they're not going to asset strip it. They're actually going to want this company to work because they're going to want it to make a profit.
For example, Thames Water, haven't they? They've been selling.
I think this is old politics. I mean, taking your point, a swipe at Labour. I couldn't really care less who the government of the day is, whether it's Labour, Tory, Lib Dems, or a coalition. I think your analogy, well, Labour done that, well, that makes it okay. No, it doesn't. I don't care in regards to who the.
No, if you're going to throw the mud around, let's aim at everyone.
However. You know, this is the government of the day. You made reference to Holland, which is very interesting because we've sent a delegation over to Holland quite a few times and we have close links with that. And I'll tell you now, if you're going to use Holland or the Netherlands as an analogy of privatisation, it is a complete and utter shambles. Loads of different companies, and what we've seen of it, actually, the universal service and the general public have suffered hugely in Holland in regards to privatisation. And I don't take your analogy when you use the likes of the British aero industry and other things in regards to certain industries and then say, well, it's the same in Royal Mail. No, it's not the same as Royal Mail. And let's get to the crux of the argument. This is about selling off an asset that makes money. And you say about investment, but we still think, you know, we can do that through Railtrack, but the government, because it's 1980s politics, isn't going to do that. And investors will come in, and they've got to make money to pay shareholders. Well, to start off with, you know, that's fine, but and I can tell you now, I've got 29 years of service in Royal Mail, so I've seen lots of different governments, I've seen lots of different chief executives, and I've seen the way that the business has gone. And I'm telling you now, you will not be able to, when a private company comes in and eventually takes over the share, and we don't even know what the government share is going to be yet, manage to maintain the universal service. The only way they'll do that is to put prices up, zonal prices, and also maybe the six-day service, because this is another debate. People say it's the six-day universal service. You can still have a universal service, and it happens in other countries, but it's not 6 days a week. Because as long as you're delivering to every household in the UK, it doesn't have to be 6 days a week. Now, the interesting thing about this debate, and I would say to any politician, is get out and meet the general public, because we've done that. And what the general public is saying in all the surveys, independent surveys, and nothing to do with the CWU or any trade union, and also, interestingly enough, the Bow Group, the right-wing think tank, has said the same thing. They think, the long-term future in regards to some of those Tory MPs that sit in rural constituencies is that they are going to suffer. Because I know how the postal system works. I've spent 29 years in it, and the reason it works is you've got one part of the business that actually makes money that offsets the universal service. Well, I can tell you now, if you have companies come in, and they already have because of the deregulation of what the previous government done through Europe, is that money, that source of money, is being stripped away. And there's no way on this earth, whether it is in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, you know, I'm not a betting person, but I can tell you in the long-term future, the universal service will be unsustainable in a private market because people have got to make money.
Kevin, just one other thing. How long are the companies that are taking, well, this is a, when it, once this is sold off, the Royal Mail, do they have to actually maintain, for example, paying conditions for your members?
Well, we've given notice to Royal Mail today on industrial action. There's a ballot going out on the 27th, which is next weekend, and closes on the 16th of October. Now, this isn't a ballot about whether the post office is sold off, because, you know, politically you cannot have an industrial action ballot about that. What it is about the terms and conditions. It's about pay, pensions, and the terms that people enjoy. And what we're having a set of negotiations with Royal Mail is about how long that is offered for. At the moment, Royal Mail have made an offer which falls well short of what our members want. They're looking at a three-year deal, which actually is enshrined in law. And there's both sets of laws from Royal Mail and the CWU in the room negotiating that. And we obviously want a lot longer. Because there's been no illusion. We know that the staff cost, the labour costs in Royal Mail, is where effectively a private company will come in and try and downsize, because that's where they've got to make money. Because Royal Mail and delivery services is labour intensive. You haven't got a machine to walk up a garden path and post a letter. And the only way you can then make money is to actually attack the terms and conditions of postal workers. And, you know, I would say again, politicians, go out and speak to your constituents. Go out and to speak in your suburbs and your streets, because the feedback we're getting is people don't want it to change. They don't need it to change. It makes money. And at the end of the day, we think the investment, apart from the profit and also investment that we could get from Railtrack, could be a it doesn't make any sense. Anybody that's looking at this industry makes no sense to privatise it.
What does it mean anything to you that this is so unpopular?
Well, it is unpopular. You know, I'm not going to deny it. I thought long and hard and read a lot about it. Obviously, I'm not going to bow to your superior experience because you have direct hands-on knowledge. But when the mail service was deregulated, as you said, the Royal Mail has faced an awful lot of income that's been bled away into other private companies. The Royal Mail is going to have to change and adapt to face those threats. You know, TNT you've already mentioned, but they're not the only ones in there that have come into the marketplace. Now, in order to do that, the Royal Mail is going to have to become as efficient as possible. Now, efficiency is enshrined within the private sector, because if you don't run as efficiently as possible, you don't function at all. But efficiency isn't necessarily the driving force in the public sector. So I do think the privatisation, and if you look at the companies...
I've got to cut in there. What you're saying is that a postal worker under a privatised Royal Mail will be more efficient than what a postal worker is now.
No, you are saying that,
and I'll tell you the reason why I take point with that is because we've had some very, very painful industrial action over the last couple of years on the issue of efficiency, right? On the issue of efficiency. And what we've seen is the mechanisation and efficiency and various agreements come into place, which has been very, very painful for our members. I've had to front up plenty of meetings with our members that aren't particularly happy with the agreements between Royal Mail. Where do you think the £404 million profits come from? It's because of efficiency changing. And what the government is doing is effectively it's taking the pensions deficit on, which was no fault of our members because previous governments took tax revenue out of Royal Mail. Royal Mail went on a pensions holiday, which meant there was a great big gap in the pensions, not the fault of our members. So effectively, they've taken the pensions deficit on, and actually, the profits they're going to give out to private investors. But I do take the point about efficiency. Our members work damn hard.
What I'm saying is they'd be more efficient
if they're private.
Kevin, can I just ask Martin, give Martin the final word? We're just coming up to the Murdoch news time. Okay. Martin, when we're talking, we've just been hearing about the criminal justice system being privatised, now Royal Mail. Does it matter?
Well, I think the idea that private is better and public is worse is facetious, and the reverse is also facetious. You know, what we really need to do is have a real discussion, like Mark was saying earlier, that he thinks it might be better off to have publicly owned buses. Yes. Let's not be dogmatic about these things, because in fact, once we start looking at real problems, then the ideology falls away.
I mean, this misses £404 million coming into the treasury, which is
yes. Can I just make this point? Because you said we've not got much time. The pension deficit being taken off by the government, that means that the taxpayer is going to pick up the tab for the pension deficit, and the private sector is going to get the Royal Mail. Now, in actual fact, if they wanted to buy the Royal Mail, they have to buy the pension viability as well, surely, if we've got a free market. And of course, nobody would be interested in
that. Not at all, because it's a massive deficit.
Well, okay. So in other words, the whole thing isn't a free market at all,
folks,
is it?
Thanks very much to Mark Weston, a deputy leader of the Conservative Group, and Kevin Beazer, who's the Regional Secretary, Communication Workers Union, Old Labour, Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the news, Syria and Iran.
Your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. The outspoken UKIP politician Godfrey Bloom has had the party whip withdrawn. It follows comments he made on the fringes of his party's annual conference, in which he referred to women